Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you shows from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. And coming up in this hour, crime stories. From Suspense in a Little While with screen actor Joseph Cotten, right now it's Mark Saber of the Homicide Squad on the ABC Mystery Theater. From February 13th, 1952, it's The Case of the Portrait in Red.
Milk of Magnesia and Bayer Aspirin bring you Mystery Theater, transcribed, and Inspector Mark Saber of the Homicide Squad.
Homicide, Inspector Saber speaking.
Hello, Mark. How's it going?
Fine. Who's this?
Hi, Magner.
Well, what's on your mind, Mr. Magner?
A client of mine has been murdered.
Which one?
DeWitt Paul.
An actor?
No, a painter. One of the most promising little artists.
What's the address, Mr. Magner?
The Mankiewicz Building, Sunset Strip, right across from the Calypso Club.
Stay right there, Mr. Magner, and don't touch anything. We'll be there in a few minutes.
The Case of the Portrait in Red. Countless people have.
Well, this is it, Tim.
Yeah. Flashy looking affair. Don't look much like an artist studio, does it?
Well, we're west of La Cienega, Tim, where everything looks like something else.
Yeah. Except murder.
Fire you. I can always get you a contract and video pictures for 5 weeks. But, sweetheart, baby, angel, doll, honey, listen to me. Look, Luscious, we'll have lunch. So what if you lose it? Okay. Yeah, what can I do for you?
Is your name High Magner?
Right.
Did you phone in a report on a homicide?
Hey, you're Mark Saber. Right this way, Mark. In here.
Some gag, eh, Inspector?
Yes, those look like stab wounds.
He's dead, all right. And has been for some time.
Well, cover it up, Tim. It looks as if the late Mr. DeWitt Paul wasn't the only victim of the stabbing.
How's that?
Well, somebody also took a knife to these paintings on the wall.
The final knife in my back. I could cry. You don't know the dough these dolls owed us for this stuff.
Who exactly are these dolls?
Just about every doll in pictures with a six-figure salary.
No, I take it Mr. Paul specialized in portraits of movie stars.
Right.
Did you ever see any of his other paintings?
There aren't any others, worst luck. This is the crop.
I see. Take Mr. Magner in the other room, Tim, and get a statement from him. Oh, and call the medic. Find out what's holding them up. I'm going to have a closer look at what's left of the late Mr. Paul's paintings.
All right. Come along now.
Don't make
any false moves if you know what's good for you.
Watch who you're shoving around, or I'll fix it so you'll never work in this town again.
Who's there?
Open up. I know you're in there.
Okay, where is she?
Who?
Don't horse around with me. I know she's in here. The car's in the driveway.
Who are you?
Ask that phony DeWitt Paul.
Well, I'm afraid I can't very well do that.
Oh, you can't you? Well, I'm going to ask him a few questions. Out of my way.
Now, take it easy. I'm warning you. Well, I'm sorry I had to do that. Here, let me help you up.
Hey, pack a mean wall up in that left of yours, mister. What's your pitch?
Inspector Saber, homicide.
Homicide? Hey, where is Pam? He's not...
No, it's your friend, DeWitt Paul. He's been murdered.
Good. Somebody save me the trouble. But listen, I got to get Pam out of here. A thing like this will wreck her career. Pam! Pam, where are
you? Hey, wait a minute. Come back here.
I bet she's in the closet.
Harry, you fool! Oh, you fool. Why did you
have
to...
Shut up. Come on out of there. I'm not going to hurt you.
Go on over there and sit down. You too, miss.
do I have to stay here? Can't you question us somewhere else?
I'm sorry, you're both under technical arrest. You can't leave the premises.
Well, I guess that settles that.
Inspector, I'm sorry. I can't get a consecutive word out of this joker.
Nuts.
Did you check the medic?
Yes, the morgue wagon's out. Can't get here for another half hour. And the examiner has to come all the way from Pasadena.
Hi, can't you get me a lawyer or something?
I need one myself. What's the big idea coming back here, Pam? I told you to stay far away from here.
Well, I'm sorry, Hi, but I had to risk it. I was afraid I'd left my keys.
Well, you should have thrown away the key to this dump before you ever came here.
Oh, Harry, now, darling, you mustn't be cruel to me. Now that DeWitt's dead, you're all I have left.
Oh, well, of all
now, keep your temper, Harry. Keep your temper.
Well,
all right, quiet. You're all going to have a chance to talk, one at a time. Now, you first. Name?
Professional or legal?
Both.
My professional name is Pamela Storrs. STORRS. In private life, I'm Mrs. Harry Fleming.
That's a laugh.
Oh, I take it you are Mr. Fleming.
Harry, darling.
Occupation?
Mark, you're kidding, aren't you? This doll is the hottest British movie import since Greer Garson.
Oh, I see. Profession, actress. Now, you're getting all this, Tim?
Yeah, sure. I got it here. This is Harry Fleming, alias Pamela Storrs.
Alias?
Miss Storrs, were you acquainted with the deceased?
DeWitt Paul was a very dear friend of mine.
Dear friend, oh.
What was the purpose of your visit here this evening, Miss Storrs?
Mr. Paul had painted a portrait of me, and he wanted to borrow it for his exhibition. I came in to ask him to fetch it out of the car, and I found it.
Where is that picture now?
It's in the station wagon, parked in the areaway.
Tim, go and get that painting out of the car.
All right. Keep an eye on them screwballs, Inspector. I don't trust them.
Mark, I wish you'd think this thing over. We could still make a deal.
Oh? What kind of a deal?
Well, what's it matter? A deal's a deal, ain't it? So it's a deal. What kind of dough does the city pay you?
Come to the point.
Okay, here's your theme. Pamela's studio's got $1 million invested in her. She gets in a jam, and along comes a city detective working for peanuts.
It's no deal, Magna.
Okay, so you're smart. You want to write your own script? Go ahead. See how far you get.
Now here's that picture, Mark. Where do you want it?
Oh, right here under the light, Tim. That's curious. Magna?
Yeah?
You say that Mr. Paul never painted anything but these commercial portraits.
Not that I know of. Why?
Well, I can't tell from this one painting. But I have the feeling this man has done a different kind of work.
You don't mean he's good.
Well, he could have been great.
What did I tell you? Greatest little painter that ever...
All right, that's probably the medic, Tim. I'll let him in. Now, take these people in the other room. They'll want this room clear.
Good evening. I wish to see Mr. Paul.
Come in. Your name, please?
I'm Adrian Montague, sir. Montague Garris, New York, London, Paris. I believe Mr. Paul's well acquainted with me.
How well acquainted are you with Mr. Paul?
Really? Must I submit to a questionnaire?
I'm afraid you must, Mr. Montague. I'm Inspector Sabre of Homicide.
Oh, then I'm too late. I hope that I can arrive here in time to prevent her doing anything rash.
Who is that, Mr. Montague?
Why, Dorothy, of course. Oh, I'm sorry. Perhaps I should explain. Paul deserted his wife in New York about a year ago, and she only recently learned his whereabouts. She became hysterical. Unhinged, in fact. Spoke of suicide, murder. As Paul's friend and patron, I felt it was my duty to follow her here and warn him. I see I'm too late.
Now, Mr. Montague, this is not going to be pleasant, but I have to ask you to identify the body.
C'est la façon dire. Where is the poor fellow?
This way.
Quel dommage. Yes, Inspector, that was Paul Linden.
Linden?
Yes, that was his real name. Fine talent.
How did Mrs. Linden learn of his whereabouts?
Through a photograph from one of the New York tabloids. I have the clipping right here in my pocket.
Oh. Artist KO'd by jealous mate of star. Cameraman Harry Fleming, husband of Pamela Storrs, is restrained by waiters as he stands over prostrate form of Filmland artist DeWitt Paul. Uh-huh. Well, I wonder how they kept this out of the Los Angeles papers.
But that, I presume, is a rhetorical question, sir. Oh, great Scott, Inspector.
What's wrong?
The portrait. Who is this woman, Inspector?
Well, that's the lady mentioned in your clipping, Pamela Storrs.
So that's the connection. I've seen this woman in the flesh, Inspector.
Where?
In New York. I saw her getting into a taxicab with Paul the day he disappeared. Where is she now?
Come along, Mr. Montague. I want you to meet her. She's just in the next room.
Why, you double-barreled pony, you've an answer
for
me.
You know,
what did you ever do for me?
Harry is a fruitcake.
Quiet, shut up or run your head.
All right, relax, Tim. You'll burst a blood vessel.
I tell you, if I don't get out of this circus pretty soon, I'll be battier than a lot of them.
All right, be patient, Tim. I think we're beginning to make some progress. Mr. Montague, this is my assistant, Sergeant Maloney.
How do you do?
Mr. Montague has identified DeWitt Paul's body. It seems that his real name is Paul Lendon, and that he was in a nightclub brawl with you only last week, Mr. Fleming.
So what?
Well, it says here you threatened his life.
Don't commit yourself, Harry. Don't commit yourself.
Well, you can check my time card at the studio. I was riding a camera there from 9 to 7:30 on stage 24.
Miss Storrs?
Yes, Inspector.
Will you step over here in the light? I want Mr. Montague to have a good look at you.
Yes, Inspector, this is definitely the woman.
Now listen, Pam, don't say a word or we get in touch with Greg. We need a lawyer.
Magna, you need a sedative. Now look here, Miss Storrs. Nobody's accusing you of anything. We are only trying to get at the truth. Why didn't you tell me you knew DeWitt Paul was Paul Lendon?
It never occurred to me. I mean, it never entered my mind. It's all been such a frightful shock.
Well, now that it has entered your mind, Miss Storrs, suppose you tell us all about it.
Inspector, I do so very much want to help.
Watch it, Pamela.
And it's all so very likely to be misunderstood. I do wish I could speak to you about it alone.
Why, of course.
Oh, no, not in there. In DeWitt's office. Just through here. Oh, what a relief to be away from those savages. I feel so safe with you. Is it Mark?
Now, Miss Storrs, about this, look, wouldn't you be more comfortable in a chair?
Oh, thank you, no. No, it rests my feet somehow to sit here on the desk. Makes me feel so deliciously free.
Yeah. Miss Storrs, when did you first meet Paul Lendon?
Last fall. It was at the opening of the Matisse show at the Modern Museum.
So you and Paul struck up a conversation and he just happened to have some of his sketches with him.
Yes, yes.
And what exactly happened between the time you met Paul Lendon in New York and the time he showed up here in Hollywood as a commercial portrait painter named DeWitt Paul?
Well, when Paul told me how that dreadful Mr. Montague had forced him to sign a perfectly frightful contract so that everything he painted belonged to Mr. Montague and how Mr. Montague gave him barely enough to live on, well, I wanted to help him, Mark. Surely you can understand that.
So you brought him back to Hollywood, introduced him to all your friends, and set him up in business.
Yes, and I might have known people would misunderstand, especially my husband. Now, Harry's the best cameraman I ever had, and I suppose I shouldn't say this, but he is so unfeeling at times.
Yes, well, Miss Storrs, this seems to just about cover the ground. Thanks for your cooperation.
Oh, you mean you're letting me go?
Yes, but I'll have to ask you not to leave town.
I've no reason to, Mark.
Yes. Shall we go back?
Mark, I don't want to go back to that great gloomy house tonight with him. Tell me what I should do, Mark.
Now, Pamela, you're a big girl. You must decide these things for yourself.
Oh, but I thought... I mean, I was so sure...
Oh. Pardon me.
Why, it's perfectly all right, Tim. What is it?
Well, the medic arrived. They've photographed the scene and they've taken it away.
good. I'm releasing Miss Stores, but I want to talk to the others downtown. Yeah, get that, Tim.
Maloney. Huh? Yeah? Yeah, yeah, I got it okay. Okay.
What's up, Tim?
Somebody just phoned in a report from Paul's home out in Laurel Canyon. Seems a woman was found stabbed to death.
Who was she?
Dorothy Linden, Paul's wife.
Power tonight.
It's these new low-pressure tires, Mark. Oh, there's the medic's car.
Ah, good. Pull in behind it, Tim.
That's you, Inspector?
Yes, where are you?
The house is up here, top of the stairs. Hello, Mark. Tim, I thought you boys would never get here.
Well, our citizens out in this neck of the woods get murdered faster than we can keep up with them.
I don't think this is murder, Inspector. I think this is suicide. Oh, excuse me. This is Mrs. Dowd, Paul's landlady.
You found the body, Mrs. Dowd?
Yes. And suicide is just what was on her mind. She said he deserted her. And if he didn't do the right thing by her, she was going to kill him and herself to boot.
Well, let's have a look at the scene.
If it's all the same to you, I'd rather not go back in there.
Oh, yes, yes, I quite understand. Now, just one more question, Mrs. Dowd. Did you see anyone approach the house after you admitted Paul's wife?
Yes, the car drove up about 10 o'clock. It was too dark to see who it was, but I thought it must be Mr. Paul coming home from his studio. There was yelling and screaming and quarreling, and he slammed out and drove off again.
Why did you come back to the house?
Well, after the way she was carrying on about killing herself and all, I thought I'd better go up and see if I could calm her down. But I was too late. She'd already did the deed.
Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Dowd. You've been most helpful.
Well, I'll be in my own house next door if you want anything. So long, handsome.
Well, let's get on with this. Right in here. That's it.
Yeah. Stabbed through the heart. Did you find any more wounds?
That's all. The knife was still in her. I had a little trouble. I'm afraid I may have smudged those prints, but it's a clear enough case of murder and suicide. Paul was stabbed numerous times in the back, and I'm sure autopsy will show this is the same weapon.
Well, I'm surprised at you, Doctor. If Mrs. Dowd was telling the truth, this woman couldn't possibly have killed her husband and then committed suicide. Because Mrs. Dowd phoned Paul after his wife arrived here, and Paul said it was all right to let her in.
Yeah. Might not have been Paul who answered the phone.
Well, it definitely couldn't have been Paul who arrived here at 10 o'clock because he was cold when we got to him.
Seems to me you're putting a lot of credence in that old woman's story.
Touché. What did you find in the other rooms?
There's only one, sort of a storeroom, a lot of old picture frames and stuff.
Well, come on, Tim.
More pictures cut to pieces, just like at the other place.
No, it's not exactly the same, Tim.
How's that?
Now, look. Look here, the signatures. The movie star portraits were signed Paul. These are signed Linden, to wit, Paul's real name. And he must have considered these up to the standard of his best work.
Well, that lets Montague out as a suspect.
Well, how do you figure that?
Well, the paintings belong to Montague, don't they? Didn't that British female tell you as much?
Yes, under the terms of that perfectly frightful contract. Uh-oh. Hello. What have we here?
Oh, all done up in ribbons and bows. Looks like a Christmas present.
But whose?
Yeah, it's another one of them paintings.
Why, Tim, you have no soul. How can you look at this canvas and say it's only another painting? Now, look at it. The bold line, yet perfectly disciplined. The purity of the colors, solidity of the flesh tones.
She looks a little skinny to me, but if you say it's good...
Why, this is a first-rate work of art by a major artist, Tim.
I was hoping it'd be a clue. I promised Maggie I'd be home for dinner tonight, and here it is 3 in the a.m.
Say, Tim, pick up that easel and bring it in the other room. Now, let's see. Where's the best light? Ah, right here. Now, the painting. Yes, that's perfect. Now, help me move that sofa around here in front of it. There. Now the stage is all set.
What for?
I want you to go round up all our suspects and bring them here. The late Paul Linden is about to have his first one-man show.
I have an early call.
What
is
about me? Six important lunch dates.
The whole thing's absurd, bringing us all this out of the world.
Presumptuous, that's what it is.
Let's move along in there.
Well, Tim, good work. Now, if all of you good people will just be seated over here.
Jove, is that a Linden? Why, yes, it is. Oh, that's remarkable.
Poor Paul. Poor dear boy.
Nuts. Okay, Mark, what's the deal?
First of all, the medical examiner has completed his report on both homicides. On the basis of his report, the coroner's jury will probably return a verdict of murder by the hand of his wife, Dorothy, who subsequently took her own life.
Oh, you mean the case is closed?
Yes, except for one detail that still needs clearing up.
And what is that, sir?
The question of this painting.
Inspector, where did you find that painting?
Why do you ask that, Miss Storrs?
Well, I just wondered, that's all.
Miss Storrs, someone destroyed every painting in this house except this one. The person who destroyed the others might have good reason to be surprised that this one is still in existence.
Well, if you must know, Paul promised me that painting for my birthday. He said he'd put it aside and nobody else would be allowed to see it until it was mine.
If that painting belongs to anybody, it belongs to me. He owed me over $3,000 in back commissions.
Oh, you brute. Mark, believe me, that painting is mine. Promise me you won't let him have it.
If you bring that painting into our house, I'll throw it in the ash can.
It's mine. He gave it to me.
Put your name on it. Show it to me. Show me your name on it.
Please, all of you. Inspector, if I may be allowed to speak.
Please do, Mr. Montague.
With all due deference, sir, the painting is not yours to dispose of. It's mine under the terms of my contract with the late Paul Linden. And I have a court order which I secured today enjoining anyone but myself from removing any works of art from these premises.
Well, dollface, I guess that ought to shut you up.
Please, Harry.
There was one other undamaged painting, Mr. Montague. The portrait of Miss Storrs that you saw in Paul's studio. Now, why didn't you make any effort to gain possession of that?
Oh, that wretched daub. Now, you're a man of discernment, sir. Surely you can see the difference between that painting and this. This is a true Paul Linden. In fact, it's his masterpiece. Anything else he painted out here has been trash.
I see. Mr. Montague, have you ever been in this house before?
Well, that's rather an impertinent question.
No, on the contrary, I consider it a very pertinent question.
May I ask why?
Because I don't agree with the medical examiner that Dorothy Linden committed suicide. I think she was stabbed to death by the same hand that murdered Paul. Mr. Montague, how could you know that all the other canvases Linden painted out here were trash unless you had seen them intact?
Well, you see, I
don't know how much money you invested in Paul Linden's career, Mr. Montague, but if what he was painting in New York was anywhere near as good as this, the Lindens in your possession were worth a small fortune.
Not necessarily. The value of a painter's work is a very tricky matter. It can bring a top price one day and the next not be worth a red cent, especially the work of a living painter.
But Paul Linden is safely dead. He can't paint any more bad things. And the bad ones he did paint here have been destroyed. Your investment is perfectly safe.
I resent your implication that I killed Paul Linden for the money involved. I killed a man that the artist might live.
Did you hear that?
Yes, yes. And the Paul Linden I used to know would have thanked me for what I did. I've rid the world of a money grubber and given it a great artist. That is my justification.
And how do you justify the killing of Dorothy?
Why, neither justify nor reproach myself for that. It was merely necessary to the carrying out of my plan.
He's getting a wild look in his eye, Inspector. Shall I put the handcuffs on him?
I don't think that will be necessary, Tim.
Thank you, sir. You're both a gentleman and a scholar. Shall we go?
That closes the file on the case of the portrait in red. Well, send it out and have it framed.
I'm certainly glad to see the end of it, Mark. Never in all my years on the force have I seen so many screwballs in one evening.
Now, watch what you say, Tim. I may go into show business myself.
Oh, as a, what do they call it, technical advisor?
Certainly not. They want me to play the lead on a radio show called Mystery Theater.
Faith in bejeebers. Have you no pride, man? And what's to become of me if there's another case like this and you're not there to protect me?
Oh, you're right, Tim. It wouldn't be fair to you. I guess I'll have to turn it down.
You're a darling man, Inspector. A darling man.
Phillips Milk of Magnesia and Bayer Aspirin have just brought you transcribed Inspector Mark Saber in the case of the Portrait in Red on Mystery Theater. Tonight's story, The Case of the Portrait in Red, was written by Robert Tallman. Inspector Saber is played by Robert Carroll and Sergeant Maloney is James Westerfield. The orchestra is conducted by Clark Whipple. The names of all characters in tonight's dramatization are fictitious, and any resemblance to names of living persons is purely coincidental. Listen again next week to Mystery Theater and The Case of the Voice of Death. America is sold on ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
The ABC Mystery Theater on Tuned to Yesterday from February 13th, 1952. If you were listening to radio that day, you could have tuned to Wild Bill Hickok or The Family Theater, The Bing Crosby Show, The Great Gildersleeve, Red Skelton, and The Lone Ranger. It's an hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and now on to Suspense with Joseph Cotten, part of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater, and also a screen actor in his own right. From September 27, 1945 on CBS, the play is The Earth is Made of Glass.
Suspense. Tonight, Roma Wines bring you Mr. Joseph Cotten as star of The Earth is Made of Glass, a suspense play produced, edited, and directed for Roma Wines by William Spear. Suspense.
Good morning, Dr. West.
Good morning, Miss Adams.
Well, there's one bed vacant this morning. I see that 4:36, Mr. Steele died, 4 a.m.
Yes, I was there. Coronary thrombosis.
You're not terribly concerned, Dr. West?
Why should I be especially concerned?
Well, the day nurse, Miss Rosenberg, said that you and Mr. Steele...
You girls gossip too much.
Yes, Doctor. But I understand there's no family. What am I going to do with Mr. Steele's things?
What things?
Well, his overcoat. This parcel was in it. This book. He said it was his journal, and he told Miss Rosenberg you were to have it. He said it had important scientific data. And...
Well, give it here.
Yes, Doctor.
Journal of Richard Thomas Steele. Important scientific data, I'll bet. I still can't figure out what was eating that guy. What he had to say to me that was so darned important. Why do people want to keep diaries? July 26th, not a fruitful day. The weather this morning was heavy, sticky. Lord knows what crazy stuff he's written here.
July 26th, not a fruitful day. The weather this morning was heavy, sticky. I stayed indoors with the blinds drawn, spent 3.5 hours arranging and cataloging a shipment of books, and I must say I gloated over my new volume of Bacon, Gold Leaf, Uncut, 1836, a treasure. In the afternoon, I ventured out to play chess with Elliot. He's an uninspired player and a worse conversationalist. I'm appalled that a man of Eliot's pretensions still wallows in 18th and 19th century thought patterns, twaddle in sentimentality. He's totally unaware of the potentialities of modern science. It was so apparent to me when we got into that argument over Ralph Waldo Emerson. I was thumbing through a volume he had of Emerson's essays, a cheap reprint at that, and I was annoyed by a paragraph in the essay called Compensation. I must have snorted because Elliot fairly leaped at me.
Certainly I think there's compensation for everything. Tit for tat, measure for measure, love for love.
Do you contend, Elliot, that no matter what a man does, it comes back to him?
One way or another, yes, yes, it does.
Then if I do good, I get good back?
Yes, I believe that, Richard.
And if I commit a crime, I'm of necessity punished?
Well, it depends what you mean by punishment.
I mean that I will suffer somehow for the evil I do.
Isn't that what Emerson says?
I want to know what you believe.
Well, I believe what he says.
Well, I'll read what he says. Discount the poetry, old man. He used lush language. Emerson says, commit a crime and the earth is made of glass. Commit a crime and it seems as if a coat of snow fell on the ground, such as reveals in the woods the tracks of every partridge and fox and squirrel and mole. You cannot recall the spoken word. You cannot wipe out the foot track. You cannot draw up the ladder so as to leave no inlet or clue. Some damning circumstance always transpires. The laws and substance of nature, water, snow, wind, gravitation, become penalties to the thief. Well, Elliot?
Beautiful, isn't it? You read very well.
Don't try to turn me off, Elliot. We're discussing his theory.
I don't see how there can be any argument. We know...
We know a good deal more than Emerson, you old fellow. Especially about the laws and substances of nature. We've tested the substances, learned control over the laws, the scientific method, Elliot. It cancels out every word your friend Emerson wrote. Let's say, in compensation.
Oh, the scientific method. I'd like to see it applied to some situations in nature. To human nature. All right. Say you commit a murder.
Murder, very well. Say I do.
Well, if you aren't caught by the police, and that can be managed by an intelligent man, you still won't escape. Call it your conscience. That's what Emerson means.
But say I commit a laboratory murder.
What kind of a murder is that?
Let me put it this way. When the police catch a murderer, they have found a connection between the murderer and his victim, motive and clues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when a murderer is caught by his conscience, it is still because he is connected with his victim through his emotions.
I agree so far.
Well, how is a murderer caught if he is in no way connected with his victim?
Well, that's not possible.
I don't know. There could be a pure abstract murder, a murder occurring in almost a vacuum, a murder in which the only connection between the two participants is the unadulterated act of killing. July 28th. The weather continues warm, humidity high. Today I roamed around my library, read a little, thought a great deal. It's odd that I should keep referring back to my conversation with Elliot. Abstract murder. A laboratory murder. I jotted down one or two theoretical points today. It will be an amusing project in such hot weather. July 29th. What utter nonsense to think as I have of a laboratory experiment carried out in writing on paper. It's a contradiction in terms. The core of the scientific method is to prove theory in life, so let us prove the possibility of a pure murder. It must be someone met in an emotional and material vacuum. Someone with whom I have no connection. Someone whom I have no possible reason to kill. The preparations for such a murder are of necessity classically simple. This afternoon, I bought my equipment.
Gloves, sir? What kind of gloves?
Oh, any kind of gloves.
But what do you want them for? Driving? Gardening?
I want gloves I can use for anything.
Well, we call these utility
gloves.
Yes,
those will be excellent, thank you.
What size, sir?
Any size, medium.
Well, now, these look just
about... No, I don't want to try them on. I'll take them as they are. Just wrap them up.
Yes, sir. Just as you say.
You know, I'm very fond of a genuine old-fashioned hardware store, Mr. Jeremy. Like yours?
Yes, a lot of people tell me that, Mr. Steele. Yeah. Anything special you're looking for?
I don't know. I suppose I'm just browsing.
Yes, sir.
Oh, what are those? Ice picks?
Yes, sir. And pre-war metal, too. You want one?
No, I have one. My, quite a selection. Screwdrivers. There's something I want.
Oh, a knife?
One of those.
Well, to be fair with you now, those are pretty poor knives.
Doesn't matter.
Well, just no darn good as far as I can see.
The best possible recommendation, Mr. Jeremy. I'll take it. A meaningless knife, all-purpose gloves, knife and gloves new, factory-made, uncontaminated by human association, smelling only of the harsh, impersonal machines which turn them out. my first safeguards against the intrusion of emotion. In a laboratory, this procedure would be called controls. To complete the controls, who would it be? I must never see his or her face. I must never know his or her name, age, occupation, thoughts, or desires. I must come into contact with this victim as casually as though we were blown together by the wind. There can be no selection, no volition on my part except the elementary volition necessary to raise my arm to kill. July 30th. The exact record of what has occurred. I must write it down now while it is fresh in my mind. I will be absolutely precise and objective. Very well. Tonight, at some undetermined hour after dinner, I left my house on 74th Street with the new gloves and knife in my right-hand coat pocket. The only external circumstance I noted was that the air was hot, heavy, and still. But after all, everyone is affected equally by weather, so my consciousness of it was no limitation on my experiment. I walked an undetermined number of blocks, taking care to observe no street signs or landmarks. I observed only one thing, that there were many people on the street. In fact, I became aware only vaguely that I was pushing through a rather dense crowd, but I deafened myself completely to any specific words or conversation.
Brilliant recording.
Brilliant.
And although I imagine there was traffic passing in the street, I successfully blotted out all sound except for a dull roar. It seemed to me that the ominous heat had increased. The stillness of the air was almost palpable. Perhaps brought me sooner to the final resolution of my plan. But when I found my progress through the crowd blocked by what I can only describe as a human, I raised my knife and drove it into the back with all my force.
I can't stand it! I can't!
What's the matter?
I continued walking without haste, pausing only a fraction of a second to hear.
He's fallen! Get back! Give him air! Give him air!
What is it?
To hear those few words. He's fallen. Give him air. He needed no air, I knew that. And thus, I heard confirmed my unqualified belief that I had taken, without any possible consequence to myself, a human being's life. August 1st. I was unable to write my journal yesterday because of the excessive heat. I suffered all day from a headache and a vibration in my ears. I'm writing today only to have on record the final control in my experiment, my laboratory murder. To assure complete ignorance of the identity of my victim, I shall read no newspapers for a period of 2 or 3 weeks, nor hold conversation with anyone apt to be morbidly interested in murders reported in the tabloid press. Compensation. Tut-tut, Mr. Emerson. August 4th. The heat is unbearable. All day I have felt that odd, heavy vibration in my head. Now also in my arms and body. It is almost constant, you know, 1, 2, 3 rhythm, and sometimes it is a sound as well as a vibration, like the distant sound of the sea. The doctor. Last night I was kept awake by the throbbing in my head, and toward morning I was subjected to a new agony. Very softly at first, but louder and louder, like voices heard in delirium, my head became filled with an almost hysterical babbling.
Brilliant.
Appassionata.
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 Brilliant.
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 Appassionata.
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 Brilliant.
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 Appassionata.
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 Brilliant.
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 It is a nightmare. Not for an instant have the voices stopped or even paused. And they seem to keep time with the reverberation of my heart. August 8th. I have no need to consult a doctor. Now I know the nature of my illness. Last night, I turned to music, trying to drive the unspeakable uproar from my brain. But when I put the records on the machine, the Frank Violin Sonata, and settled back to hear the first flowing melody of the violin, something happened. The music swelled and changed and became the Appassionata, Beethoven's Appassionata.
Brilliant.
Then I knew. I turned off the music. The devilish cycle began once more. The sound and voices rose to a bedlam, shrieking like the voices of fiends, rose to a dreadful climax. In spite of every precaution, my murder had not taken place in a vacuum. My shield had been penetrated by those fragments of sound and speech echoing in my ears. Speech about a concert. Yes, I remember now. I read that Schnabel was to play an all-Beethoven concert in Carnegie Hall on July 30th. And the clanging of bells? That was a trolley going by on 7th Avenue. And I'd also heard and identified the roll and crash of summer thunder. That was the sound which preceded and punctuated a woman's scream.
I can't stand it! I can't! He's fallen! Get back!
What's
give
the matter?
Him here!
What's the matter? What happened?
Get back!
Well, it may be possible to drive all this away in time. But the other thing which sets the rhythm for the rest, the pulsing sound I hear. When I drove that knife home into a human being's heart, the vital rhythm of the heart, the mighty leap and contraction of the heart's muscle on the blade of the knife was transmitted back to me through my hand and remains indelibly recorded in the beat of my own blood. August 11th. While I am still able to reason, I must discover where I erred and act swiftly to correct my error. There is no turning back. The death I caused is a fact. I cannot banish it by wishing, for each day I remember something more. Today, the color of his hair. Photographed between the black collar of his coat and his gray hat, I saw it. Clipped, silky, reddish. And I had an insatiable desire to turn the head to see his face. There is one course left to me. I will reverse my plan. I will learn. I will learn in every possible detail the person whom I killed. Learn to know him. Construct a total portrait. Then I will attempt to discard this portrait in its entirety. I beg your pardon, miss. Where are the newspaper files?
Well, I'll have to get them for you. What dates did you want to see?
The week of July 30th.
Which paper?
The Times. I'll start with that.
Just a moment.
I want them for the whole week.
Yes, well, here are all the copies for July, bound. And these loose ones are August so far.
Thank you.
They must not be taken out of the reading room. The reading room is to your right. Will you need them long?
It may take me some time. I don't know. I'm doing some rather intensive research.
Return them to the desk when you're through.
I open the bound volume near the end and immediately saw his picture, page one, center. The photograph was blurred, but without reading a word, I recognized him because he matched his hair. I mean, his face went with the back of his head, the one who I had seen. The hair growing to a slight widow's peak, eyes widely spaced, gray or very light blue, mouth wide, young and strong. Then I read the words above the picture. Young man slain in crowd. That was all I read because at a moment, someone spoke to me.
Pardon me. When you're finished with that volume, may I look at it?
It was impossible. It couldn't be. Standing at my shoulder, smiling, young, apparently as alive as I, but it was. He was there, he, my victim. The face in the paper and his face were the same. I swear they were the same.
I'm sorry to bother you. The girl at the desk said you had the July volume of the Times.
Yes,
Sorry. Did I startle you?
Your picture, I'm looking at your picture.
My picture? Well, you mean in the paper? I don't see any picture.
He's dead. I know he's dead. I felt his heart leap like a fish on the point of my knife, then quiver and die. I saw him fall. I must believe that he is truly dead. and the dead neither walk nor speak. But today on Fifth Avenue. Hello.
What?
What's wrong? Are you ill?
No. No, I'm all right.
You looked like you were about to faint. You're still green. Are you sure
I'm,
that you're...
I'm all right.
Because I live right near here if you want to lie down.
No, please.
Well, it's up to you. I can't make you come. But I don't like to see anyone suffer needlessly. August 20th. He doesn't like to see anyone suffer. Yet because of him, there is not one day, one hour when I am free from despair and fear. Yes, I accept him now. The dead do walk and talk, at least one dead man does. Inevitably, if I venture out of my house, he finds me. Today, I started down the subway steps at 53rd Street after I'd looked to make sure he wasn't anywhere nearby. But I'd gone only three or four steps when I felt my arm jostled and I turned...
Pardon.
Oh, you again. I'll bet you think I'm haunting you.
Please, what do you want?
Look, I don't want anything. Let's just call it fate or something.
Why don't you let me alone?
I'd begun to think that maybe we were both to be spared this.
So had I.
If I were superstitious, I'd say we had some unfinished business.
Please, will you tell me something? Will you answer one question? Do you believe in compensation?
You'll have to explain what you mean.
If someone does evil, if I have done evil, must I get evil back?
Well, say it again.
Do you believe in good for good, evil for evil? Look, what about killing?
Well, there's all sorts of killing.
But senseless killing. Killing with no reason. What is the compensation for that?
You've asked a pretty complicated question of a pretty simple man. The only thing that comes to my mind right off is what it says in the Bible. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth.
That's what you believe?
Why, yes, I believe that. Is that any help to you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Anything you say would help. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, like a man. The price asked by the only one who can ask it. What will you have, quoth God? Pay for it and take it. Well, I'll pay. For I've learned that no event between two human beings can happen in a vacuum. We're all enmeshed, bound together through our blood in a pulsing net. And if one of us does violence to another, he does violence to himself. Very well. This price I am glad to pay. There is no other way.
Are you awake, Mr. Steele?
Where am I?
You're in Washington Hill Hospital. How do you feel?
Hospital, but I mustn't. I have to die.
Not if we can keep you from it.
I have to. Did I bleed much?
Bleed?
From the knife.
You had a heart attack, Mr. Steele. Coronary.
No, I tell you here. I stabbed myself here. Where's the doctor?
Lie down, Mr. Steele. The doctor will be here in a minute.
I have to make him understand. I promised to die.
You promised? Oh, here's the doctor now.
Yes, but I... You. Of course, you.
Well, Mr. Steele...
I tried to tell her. I tried to tell her that I have to die.
Call another doctor for this patient, nurse.
But doctor...
You tell her. The earth is made of glass. That if I don't die, you'll always find me. I know that. But tell her. Tell her the evil thing I have done so she'll let me die.
Dr. West, his pulse.
Emerson said it. I carry a malignity in me. But when I die, I make square the eternal account. Make square the eternal account.
Well, Miss Adams, that's all there is. The Journal of Richard Thomas Steele.
Doctor, I don't remember reading of that murder. Do you?
No. No, I don't.
Who was the man he met? Who was it he thought he'd killed?
It was me.
You, Dr. West?
Just as he described it. First in the library, then in the drugstore, near my home, on buses, in the park. I couldn't imagine what was bothering him.
But who did he kill? Really?
I don't know. But I have an idea. Where's the package you found in his coat?
Right here. Shall I open it?
Yes, go on. You see?
The gloves. And the knife.
And they've never been used.
Then he never killed anyone.
No. Richard Steele never drove a knife into a living back. But in his way, he killed. In his mind, he killed. I guess old Emerson would say even for that kind of crime, there's compensation. Commit a crime, and the earth is made of glass.
Roma Wines have brought you Joseph Cotton as star of The Earth is Made of Glass. Tonight's study in Suspense.
Suspense on Tuned 2 yesterday, Joseph Cotton starring in a CBS broadcast from September 27th, 1945. And that closes our cases in this hour of Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from the golden age of radio. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.